This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Public television fans will recognize marine biologist Dr. Carl Safina from his series, Saving the Ocean, which took viewers around the globe in search of good news about ocean life. He spoke with the Cincinnati Zoo's Thane Maynard about his latest book, which takes him away from the water and into the lives and minds of animals, called Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel.
Hi, Dr. Carl Safina. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Well, we'll talk about a lot of things, but certainly what prompted this is your great new book called Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. And to be honest, like a lot of PBS watchers and NPR listeners, I had thought of you more around saving the oceans from your great 10-part series there. But this goes well beyond just whales to elephants and poaching and all kinds of things. Tell us a bit about this book in particular.
Well, this book is different from my others because this one is an attempt to get inside the minds of animals. So not just showing what is at stake or how much is at stake, but who is at stake and who is here with us on the planet and how they value their own lives and how vivid the experience of living is to them.
And certainly in some of the stories in there, I've been fortunate to visit East Africa, so I was really taken by your tales of elephants surviving everything from drought to human encroachment to, of course, poaching in places surrounding Amboseli National Park in Kenya. It's remarkable sometimes to imagine that with all the poaching that there still are big herds of elephants.
There are big herds of elephants in a few sections of the continent, and most of their populations are cut off from one another now. So the number of elephants is down really sharply from what it was just 30 years ago. And there are only really a few places where significant elephant populations exist outside of designated areas.
Absolutely, and unfortunately that's a story retold with African lions, tigers, a variety of endangered species with fragmented populations. But, you know, elephants in particular really lend themselves to your story in this book, this idea that animals, of course, have minds, but that they also have feelings.
Yes, yes. And they have lives, and they are individuals who, whose lives individually matter to them and to the other ones around them. Often, if an individual elephant is killed, the ones who survive suffer even more because they may have just lost their mother and their leader. So these are individuals who know each other and who have real lives.
Absolutely. I know you talk about wolves in the book as well, and there's been a tremendous amount learned, of course, in the last 20 years with the reintroduction of wolves in Yellowstone, and they're spread throughout the Northern Rockies. But still lots more to learn ahead of us?
Well, I think we've learned almost nothing, really. People only started watching wild animals live their lives, just studying the behavior of free-living animals, only around 1960. Mm-hmm. And really all of the pioneers are still working. People like Jane Goodall and Cynthia Moss and Ian Douglas Hamilton and George Schaller. I mean, they're all still alive and they're all working. I mean, it's just instructive to realize that we have hardly even begun to scratch the surface, and in very few areas and for very few species.
And you're right. In those early days, in the early 60s, when people like Jane Goodall came back to report to the Royal Society about animal behavior and individual differences and that chimps have moods, she got a lot of resistance. But of course, anyone who has read Jane Goodall or knows her knows that resistance or not, she knows what she's talking about.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a strange kind of a thing that says a lot about us, that a person can go to a place where these creatures live and can spend months watching them and can come back and say, they actually have individual personalities, and some are shy and some are bold and some are ambitious and some are timid, and have somebody who hasn't been there and hasn't looked at them say, Oh, no, they don't. And you can't say anything like that. I mean, you know, really, what does that say about us and our supposedly open scientific minds? I'm a scientist, and I am sometimes appalled at how much like other people many scientists are. You know, we're supposed to be very open-minded and very evidence-based, but a lot of scientists are just people, after all, and subject to many of the same sorts of weaknesses and closed-mindedness.
Your career certainly is one of interest. As listeners may know, you've in the past been a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant, of course, fellowships from the Pew Foundation, the Guggenheim Foundation. And in addition to doing your work and research, you're also, I know, a part of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. And so tell us a bit about that. In the past, say when I was coming up, scientists didn't really communicate with the general public.
That was considered to be unprofessional of all things. And the only value to science is that you tell other people what you've found. And that's another very strange thing, that scientists insist that you must publish or perish. But if you try to say what you found to somebody who is not in your field, this is somehow looked down upon. And I think that that has been catastrophic to science and to public understanding and opened up a gigantic weak spot that can be filled by people who have their own agendas at heart, because there are no scientists often in the debate to say, wait a second, you're completely wrong about this, and you know, and here's why you're saying it, and show that the various emperors have no clothes when they talk about this. But there are very few scientists who are even known to the public because, as I say, catastrophically, this is often considered to be something that is not professional, especially in environmental and ecological sciences. I mean, if you were in the engineering department, you wouldn't be called unprofessional for pointing out that there was a fatal flaw in a bridge. But for some reason, in lots of the other sciences, you're just supposed to talk to other scientists. And I don't know why people think that being in an echo chamber like that is the only thing of value, because it's clearly only part of what is of value in science. And I might even argue that it's the least of it.
Well, you know, and another side to that, of course, is sometimes when someone, whether that is Carl Sagan 40 years ago or E.O. Wilson today, if they do get to be a household name or a lot of notoriety, perhaps even Carl Safina, some colleagues might end up acting contrary to that just out of jealousy.
Yeah, I don't disagree that there is some of that. I don't personally get it. I don't feel it. And people where I am don't respond to me that way at all. And I guess, you know, since I don't have that axe to grind, I think I can say there is some of that, and I've seen some of that.
Now, tell us a bit about the Safina Center. I know you're the founding president. And is that a separate nonprofit, or is it part of Stony Brook? Or tell us what work you do there.
It's a separate nonprofit, and it's essentially my platform for my writing and speaking. We had it long before I actually came to the Stony Brook University, so it was already there. And we have fellowships for certain particular very creative people whose work really resonates with mine. We mainly try to do products that people can use and share. So our work is not going to meetings, which in the policy world, a lot of work is going to meetings, and a lot of work is writing reports that are not intended for the public. And those are all important things. I'm not knocking them at all, but that's not what our work is. What we do is we write things that are intended to be seen by many, many people, and we write things on the web. We write things in major newspapers and magazines. We write books. We do films and TV shows and that kind of thing, mainly. And then we also have a contract with Whole Foods, the supermarket chain, where when we help them evaluate wild-caught fish that they're considering selling. So if they have something that they want to sell, we evaluate its relative sustainability and whether it is caught with damaging methods or catches things that they're not trying to catch, or whether it's well-managed and a pretty clean fishery. So if you actually go to the seafood counter, you can see our logo right there on the counter when you go to buy seafood at Whole Foods.
And that is a very helpful service because many, many people are aware enough to know that fisheries are under pressure all over the globe and yet not well enough informed to know exactly which fish they ought to try to buy. There's a lot of confusing various types of salmon and tuna, and so that's a neat thing to have somebody who's an expert in your team review it. Now,
yeah, it takes a lot of work reviewing. I mean, it is confusing. It's not like if you don't know, there's no reason to feel uninformed about it. It's difficult. There's a lot of details, and it is confusing, and it takes us a lot of work to do it well.
Your book, I really did find remarkable. I know you've written 6 or 7 books, but your new one, Beyond Words, I think it's great because it really does ask us to reexamine our relationship with other species and to think of them differently, both as individual lives and as having feelings. So here toward the end of this this interview, which has been a lot of fun for me, I've known your work for a long time, send us off with just some thoughts on that question of reexamining our relationship to other animals.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is that regardless of how it might be viewed, I am not trying to get people to see our relationship with other animals differently as much as I'm trying to get people to see what other animals really are and who and how they really are. The implications of that, of course, are that we would see our relationship with them differently. But I'm not trying to tell you to do that. I'm trying to show you who they are, and I think that a different relationship flows automatically from seeing them as they actually are, because mostly we don't really know anything about animals. We don't spend a lot of time watching them at all. And we might get a fleeting glimpse here and there of something. If you see a wolf once in your life, that's a really big deal. If you go to Africa and happen to see some elephants, that's a really incredible experience to have. But to understand who these elephants are from people who have watched them for 40 years, or who have seen wolves every day for a decade and a half and know the individual trajectories of all their lives and what happens when a leader of the group is shot, or what has happened with killer whales over 4 decades of different generations, and the aftermath of the captures of the 1970s are still reverberating in those wild families. That's a whole different thing to realize.
My guest has been Dr. Carl Safina, author of the new book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel.